Hi. All right, today is part two, omens, oracles, and execrations of the Bible and the surrounding world. And I'm starting with something we spoke about last week, but I didn't have an image of, and I'm trying to, when I mention something and I don't have an image, I'm trying to, you know, when I'm doing a multi-part thing, I'm trying to remember to add an image so that we know what we were talking about last week. For those of us who are here, these are the Chinese oracle bones that we spoke about. And you've got the bovine scapula. Come on. Okay, got the bovine scapula, and you've got the underpinnings of the tortoise. And these are the readings on the court marks for those oracles to see what they mean. And I just thought I would show you what they were. And as I said, these are the oldest known writings from China. All right, Deuteronomy 18:20. But any prophet who presumes to speak in my name an oracle that I did not command him to utter, or who speaks in the name of other gods, that prophet shall die. Wow. There's no if, ands, or but in these statements. This is a deuteronomistic, that's a very difficult word to say, a deuteronomistic statement. It's late put into the text. We'll talk about that a little bit later as we move along today. But it's very clear. God speaks to the prophet. The prophet can utter that oracle. The prophet speaks at the behest of and the direction of God. Anybody else, they die. That works in with the whole idea of don't take God's name in vain. We have a lot of silly superstitions around that, that you can't say, you know, God D it. I say it all the time, but I don't know how offended I would make you if I said that. But that has nothing to do with what the commandment is. First of all, as I keep saying, God isn't God's name. God is God's job description. And it has to do with taking God's name, doing something in God's name that is not of God. Swearing a false oath. I swear to God, I swear to, you know, Baal or to Asherah or to the Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's taking God's name in vain. Saying, I am a prophet of the Lord, and that not being true, that's taking God's name in vain. That prophet isn't an actual prophet. That person shall die. Okay. Just to show you what I do on my days off. This is a painting of the three witches from Macbeth that's hanging in the Huntington Library where I was on Monday. I'm trying to add left coast culture into this. And this is the translation of what you can't see, but I was able to see on the bottom, it's from Medea, of the frame, right? You look at the witches, they're ugly. They have this sort of hagging face. They are horrible. That's what we think of when we think of witches. We rarely think of, you know, Samantha and Bewitched. When we think of witches, we think of these old, ugly women. And this brings us back to what we were talking about in our first night together at Tarbut V'Torah, which is somewhere around here. I can point that way. There's a playground over there. That way, okay. That way, at Tarbut V'Torah. In the book of Samuel. Now, Samuel had died, and all Israel made lament for him, and he was buried in his own town of Ramah. Right? That's Samuel the prophet. And Saul had forbidden recourse to ghosts and familiar spirits in the land. Saul thinks he's still king of Israel. David is king of Israel. Saul wants to get information from God, get information from the Kadosh Baruch Hu, but Saul has been cut off because David has been anointed king. But Saul is still looking for that information. And Saul inquired of the Lord, but the Lord did not answer him. either by dreams or by Urim or by prophets. Right? The acceptable ways in the large context to interact with God, for us to get information, is by dreams, by these binary oracles which we spoke about, or the priestly breastplate, or through the prophets. When God wants to speak to us, God speaks to us in these ways, but we can inquire of God in these three ways as well. And the prophet had died, Saul is cut off. All right. There are other ways of dealing with oracles, other ways of getting information from God in the ancient world. And I think that's one of these, the initial sort of teaser questions that we had sent out at the beginning before my trip actually came together, is of what does shaken arrows have to do with anything? Here's a couple of verses from Ezekiel. Choose a way for the sword to advance on Rabbah, the Ammonites, or on the fortified Jerusalem and Judah. For the king of Babylon has stood at the fork of the road, where two roads branch off, to perform divination. He has shaken arrows, he has consulted teraphim, and inspected the liver. In his right hand came up to the omen against Jerusalem to set battering rams, to proclaim murder, to raise battle shouts, to set battering rams against the gates, to cast up mounds, to erect towers. This is the beginning of the siege of Jerusalem, when Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, set siege to Jerusalem, which ends in the destruction of the temple. And last week's Haftarah in Jeremiah spoke about that, if you would want to start, you know, combining our Torah study with our talks. So what's happening here is that the king of Babylon is at a crossroads. Should I take this road? Should I take this road? Should I set siege to Jerusalem? Should I set siege to Newport Beach? What? The distances don't matter in this analogy. Okay? And he consults with the gods. He shakes the arrows. He consults the teraphim. He inspects the liver. Now, shaken arrows are very much like the oracle bones that we spoke about, I guess it's 2 weeks ago on Sunday, where it's almost like dice, where you'll throw it, or like the magic eight ball on my first slide. So you'll have a number of arrows in a quiver, and the way they land out is the way you read it. And there are all sorts of games like this that kids have even nowadays, where you'll throw out sticks. I think they call them oracle sticks, right? You'll throw out sticks, and if there are, you know, three red and two whites, you know, which way it falls, it means this. And if it falls out that way, it means that. That sort of reading. And that's what shaking arrows is all about. But then we have the teraphim and the liver inspection. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. Are we all with me? Okay. Okay, so this is the beginning of, well, it's actually an entire scene of a liver inspection. What you do when you inspect a liver is the priest will ask a question of the god. The priest will ask the god to inscribe it on the answer on the liver. But there's a question as to whether or not, there's some people who think that if it's a small animal, not with the large animals, but if it's a small animal, if it's a goat or a sheep. In the ancient world and even in the Bible, you divide animals into two categories, large head and small head. Right? So bull and cow are one category, sheep and goat, right? So it's tzon and bakar. Right, which is small head and large head. Tzon can be sheep, tzon can be goat. It's a size matter sometimes, but that's a discussion for one of the other talks. But if it's, right, if it sounds like a joke, it is. So the priest, if it's a small animal, there are people who think that the priest would actually whisper the prayer into the ear of the animal, so that the god of would write the answer on the liver. I don't make this stuff up, I just bring it to you. I know it's a little bit odd. So what you have here is the preparation, right, for the sacrifice, all the way down to the, right, preparing here, right, you're sacrificing here, and you're taking it apart, you're taking the extra out, and then you are examining it. You can examine all different types of extra. They tend to examine mostly, in this context, the liver. Right? And there's a close-up of that where you can see he's, where's my, oh, there it is, where you can see that he's actually putting his hand into the animal to remove the liver for examination. Now, we'll remove a lung for examination if an animal is going to be glatt kosher, right? Glatt is smooth. And so in order for an animal to be glatt kosher, the lung has to be removed, and it has to be smooth, which is why it's ludicrous to have glatt kosher dairy. But you do see signs for that in places, but I've never seen milk with a lung. But whatever. I'm always willing to learn. Okay, well, so that's just a better picture of it. I don't know why there are two of them there. Okay, so that's a liver model. Okay, this shows you a, because this was before that one, and then there's yet another one. This shows you what a liver looks like, and this shows you how it works back up on the liver model. So those of us who know what a liver looks like, or you know, a liver and a gallbladder, you can then see, right, the gallbladder here, and this will show you how the liver models work in the ancient world, and this should be another slide of one. But if you look closely, you see that it's divided into quadrants, and there are holes, and you can actually, on the computer, you can actually make out the fact that there's cuneiform writing here. Right? Each one of these has different pieces of writing on it. Is that better? Yes. Much better. Okay, so now you can see, right, these are all cuneiform signs, and it actually has cuneiform writing on it. Right? This is a different type of liver model. This one to me looks much more like a liver. This one looks much less like a liver. This one on one side says, if the heart of the country changes, the omen, the other side, the omen imprisonment, where gaps were opened and the army Ishmadagan was taken. I don't have a clue as to what that means. But whoever's asking the question understands what the answer is. Right? Oedipus goes to the Oracle at Delphi and says, who are my parents? You're destined to marry, kill your father, marry your mother, and sire children by her. Is an answer that makes no sense, but it makes more sense than if he went up and said, okay, do I attack Orange County, or do I attack Jerusalem? Right? So you have to, on some level, know what the question is before you get the answer. This is unfavorable, but if it appears in the left part, it's favorable, says this side. Right? Because they divide the liver up into quadrants. So a marking on, you know, here means terrible things, but if it's the same marking or the same, you know, deformity here, it means good things. So it depends upon which side it's on, right? If it's on the front or on the back, and it's very, very, very technical. This is very much like those omens we looked at last week when we had those anomalous birth omens. Remember those lists? And they spent a lot of time collecting information on the ominous births. It's the same thing with the liver omens, and there are scads of these. There are books, you know, large books published with just the texts of these liver omens. There are a gazillion of them. This is a manual. This shows you, I mean, this is a Gray's Anatomy, so to speak, of the liver. Okay, this is the textbook that you as the priest would have, or the prophet, or the practitioner, better word in this context, right? The practitioner would have, so you can evaluate, because you see where it is, and then you can make a one-to-one correspondence. First question, second question.
So who wrote this Stephano?
No, this is, okay. I wasn't clear, I'm sorry. Thank you for the question. The question is, who wrote this stuff on the liver? This isn't a liver, this is a liver model. These are clay models that allow you to look at a liver, right? And see, so if there's a marking here, it means X. If the marking is here, it means not X. It's a training manual, exactly. Yes, two, three,
yeah,
four.
Why did they pick the liver to do this?
I'll tell you. But you gotta wait till I get there. Okay?
What if it's a diseased liver?
Well, that's the point. It is a diseased liver.
Otherwise it would be smooth.
Oh, right. It is a diseased liver.
How old are these tablets that you're showing here?
These tablets start and 2000, and they go through to Etruscan times. I'm going to show you some through in Etruscan. So you got 2,000 years of stuff. Norm, you were next, weren't you?
I'm four.
You're four.
Three.
I got three.
You said that the priest is the one who's reading and interpreting this.
Yes.
Is it a single priest? Is there a committee? Does anybody oversee the priest and check the decision? And how do we know that the priest isn't answering, throwing in his opinion and...
Of course they are. Of course they are. Okay? They are individuals, but they are trained. And there could be an apprentice and someone checking. It could be a group of, like, today is, you know, these five people are doing it, but it's all over the place. So if you're a Baru priest, this is what your job is. And you've been trained to do this.
So where are these...
I'm just doing it in the order that I see.
Did some societies use birds too?
Yes, I think we talked about birds last week. They don't open the exit of the birds in my part of the world, but you do look at the flight of birds, and we spoke about some of that last week. And you look at the flight of birds, the Romans do, the Greeks do, the Romans even, one of the slides that I showed last week had a wand that you would designate out sacred space. Right? And in the Near East, they do as well. There's a marvelous little problem in the understanding of the Noah story that deals with bird omens. Okay? In the Noah story, the first bird that they send out of the boat is a crow raven carrion eating stupid bird to send bird. Right? You send out one of those crow raven carrion eating stupid bird to send birds, and then the next bird you send is a dove pigeon not stupid bird to send bird. Okay? In all the Mesopotamian versions of the story, it's the opposite. You send the not stupid bird first, then you send the stupid bird. Right? And when I say stupid, I mean, if you think about, you know, your Noah floating on the water, right? And you send out a carrion-eating bird. All that bird sees is party. Because he lands on the floating elephant. And then he eats the floating elephant. Woo-hoo! Then he's going to go jump over to the floating hippopotamus. Right? And then to the giraffe, and then to anything else that's around. He's not going to come back. Right? So it's silly to send that bird out to see if there's any way for us to have habitable land. In Mesopotamia, they do it the other way. So one of the things our text does is switch it, and that has to be for bird omens. Because it's not going to be counted again among the white birds, says one of the recensions. And so there's got to be a reason in the omen world, right, in the reading of signs, that we turn around and we flip it. Right? And we don't know what it is. Last question, then I'm going back to what I'm talking about.
I was just going to ask, are these found all over the world? Or?
No, we're just dealing with my area, which is the ancient Near East. These are all Mesopotamian. All of this is cuneiform that we're talking about today. in this. Okay, so this is just another way of looking at it. You can see what the reason I have this is because you have it on both sides, and you can see how it's all written out, because I like to show you the line drawings as well, because then you can see the cuneiform better, but of course you can't see it at all. All right, so this is from an extypicy handbook, and extypicy means examining the exta, examining the innards being the liver. If a design is drawn from the center of the top of the station of the gate to the palace and a weapon mark points to it, I don't know what these mean, a leader will enter the country. If a design is drawn from the center of the gate of the palace to the station, the gods have heard the wailing of the land. If, that was a joke, a design is drawn between the station and the path, a god will request an emblem or a censer from a man. If a design is drawn twice between the station and the path, a man's wife will have her husband killed. Woo! The reason that I took these as examples is that you see that it is all elements of society. A new leader is going to enter the land. You're going to have famine. A woman is going to murder her husband, whatever it is. There are all sorts of information. There are all sorts of questions. There are all sorts of oracles. There's all sorts of prognostications and predictions that you can get from the liver. Okay, so these are other liver models. I mean, they're just every blanking word. This one is really unusual. This is a bronze liver model, and this is Etruscan. Right? And, I mean, that's the way it's just written out in the Etruscan. We don't know very much about it. The Etruscans don't do a lot of it, but we do have enough of it to make the connection. So, the king of Babylon is standing at the crossroads. Do I go to Jerusalem? Do I go to Orange County? I'm going to consult the liver. And the liver says, go to Jerusalem. And he sieges Jerusalem, and the temple is destroyed. So what happens? Right? There have been studies done, and I don't know the details of them, but they have looked at specifically sheep liver and seen what affects a sheep liver. And there have been people who have looked at different diseased livers and were able to make certain connections to some of the markings on some of the liver models. You then correlate out to disease, and you then correlate out to certain communicable diseases, especially diseases of grain. So, if a sheep has this marking, whatever that is, on their liver, they've been able to figure out it means that the grain in the area that they are pasturing in is diseased in this way, and that's a disease that the people might have as well. And a diseased population is a weaker population than a non-diseased population. So should I go this way? You know, should I go to Tustin or should I go to Anaheim? I'm just coming up with California towns. I don't know the distance at all, right? In Tustin, the people don't seem to be diseased because the sheep liver isn't diseased. But in Anaheim, they are diseased. I'm going to go attack in Anaheim. And there's been some very, very interesting work putting all of that together. Now, that's not to say that all of this works that way by any stretch of the imagination, but they have been able to come up with some things that work that way, and therefore, right, there's an assumption that other things can work that way. But at the same time, when a cat crosses in front of you and that cat happens to be black, right, you can interpret that as your luck is bad, because you forget where you parked your car. But you can interpret that as, oh, that doesn't matter, because while I was on my way to looking for the car, I missed the phone call that would have gotten me into an argument with my friend. Right? So a lot of it has to do with how we view all of it as well. You had a question.
I was just going to say, these would seem also fascinating to historians or people studying the time, just for these handbooks. the issues that they...
No question about it. We spend a lot of time with that.
Just like the fact that they even have a section about women killing their husbands.
Yes. Yes, because it's an important thing to do sometimes. Exactly, but it does give you an eye into the world, and that's when, you know, I know you were at the talk when we talked about the letters to the dead. It's eavesdropping into the daily life problems of people. It's marvelous. Yes.
So were livers used for certain types of decisions, and bird omens used for other types?
It depends upon how you're trained. I'm trained to look at birds, and he's trained to look at livers. Whoever you want to, but you can't go to the mold reader if you're in Israel.
Just where do you go to see these things in museums?
This one,
not this one particular. I'm saying these in general. Are they?
They're rarely on display. Frequently, they're in the tablet rooms.
Because this group of unusual people will go to museums and ask for the liver things, and people will stare at them.
Yes, yes, yes. No, no question about it.
Or the sex ones from last night.
Yeah, you don't have a lot of this stuff on display in museums. I'm just trying to think if there's anyone. When we do the magic bowls and stuff, those are on display. But this sort of stuff doesn't tend. People don't display cuneiform tablets because they're not splashy. Right, so because if you're going to display a cuneiform tablet, you need to have a large description of what it is with it. So, you know, the Metropolitan Museum will have, how many people are coming to the New York trip? I'm supposed to keep plugging the New York trip, okay? So on the New York trip, we can, if you do the Saturday extra tour with me, then we can look at some of the cuneiform tablets and the seal cylinders that they have on display. But it's not this stuff. Okay, yes.
Were both healthy and diseased livers used?
The livers were used of the animal that they sacrificed. They did not know going in that the animal would have a diseased liver. You do not sacrifice to a god a diseased animal. So the animal is not diseased, as far as you know, at the time of the sacrifice.
But they knew afterward, and they still...
They didn't know it was diseased. They didn't think of it as diseased. We all think of it as diseased.
Oh.
Okay, they think of it as if there is something written on it, the gods wrote on it. Okay.
And why didn't they use like other organs like the heart or the lungs?
Because the liver is where everything was written, because the liver was the seat of the emotions. Right? The heart is the seat of the intellect. And the brain, as I like to say, is cooked cauliflower. V'yahavta eis Hashem Elohecha b'chol levavcha u'v'chol nafshecha b'chol me'odecha. Right, you will love the Lord your God with all your heart. Right, that's not the emotional heart. That's your intellectual. That's the seat of the intellect, and the liver or the kidneys is the seat of the emotion. And this works anywhere you are in the ancient Mediterranean world. And that it's probably going to work in a little bit to the sermon that I'm going to wind up giving on Shabbos morning, but I'm not 100% sure. Last question, and then back to my talk. I spent too much time working on this to not have enough time finishing it.
So if how come we don't have in Judaism prayers that mention the liver, if the liver is important like that to all of them?
Prayer is much later. Prayer is a later construct than all of this, right? Prayer is Talmudic. Judaism is Talmudic. This is before that. We're not into Judaism. We're still an Israelite. Okay. Now our next thing, right? We got the arrows, the livers, and we have the teraphim. Meanwhile, Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel stole her household idols. Those are the teraphim. And Rachel, I'm jumping verses, obviously, because I'm only taking the verses where I have this word. I'm hearing people talking, but I'd rather hear myself. Thank you. Rachel, meanwhile, had taken the idols and placed them in the camel cushion and sat on them. And Laban rummaged through the tent without finding them. For she had said to her father, "Let not my lord take it amiss that I rise before, that I cannot rise before you, for the period of women is upon me." Thus he searched but could not find the household idols. Those are the teraphim. So are these big or are these little? They're little, they're little. So, the teraphim of the Hebrews, okay? You know how hard it is to find a picture of teraphim? Okay, but this is the best I could get, and it's actually wonderful. Kircher's work is fantastic for this sort of stuff, mid-17th century. And this shows you the teraphim. These are household idols. Where is my little? There we go. Right? And you can see that they are not necessarily small. And I love it. It's like in a little roadside shrine. You know, like those little Mary. I don't know if you have them here. When you people, you'll drive on the road and you'll see people have those little Mary shrines.
Yeah.
Yeah, the blue background and then the little white Mary. So that's what this looks like. I don't know why it's a blue background all the time. But that's what this... That's what this looks like here. Somebody on this side is talking and it's echoing in my mind, so I'd appreciate it, thank you. And these are clearly on the analogy of Egypt, right? Because he did a lot of stuff with Egypt and the look of Egypt, okay? And there have been people, those of us who were there last night, how many of us were here last night, okay? So we know that these are often interpreted as fertility figurines. I knew that. Remember I said one of my slides had a measuring stick on it? I was in the wrong, it was in the other presentation. Okay, these are fertility figurines. Right? But they could also be household fertility figurines, household idols. So Rebecca took those idols, right? She took these little votives with her. They're small, but the point that is being made is that whoever has those household idols has on some level the birthright. That's mama's candlesticks. That's daddy's pocket watch. That is the legacy of the household who is going to be the paterfamilias. And I use that term specifically because you have that term in Rome, and in Rome, whoever has the ancestral gods in their home is the head of the household. And that's what she's doing when she's taking, that's why Laban is apeshit over, didn't say that into the microphone, over the fact that they're missing. Okay. Book of Samuel, first book of Samuel, 19, 10 to 17. That night Saul sent messengers to David's home to keep watch on him and to kill him in the morning. We talked about this before. David and Saul are in conflict because Saul thinks he's king and David thinks he's king. But David's wife Michal told him, unless you run for your life tonight, you'll be killed tomorrow. Michal let David down from the window and he escaped and fled. Michal then took the household idol, the teraphim, I didn't give it to you in Hebrew, but that's what it says there, laid it on the bed and covered it with a cloth, and at its head she put a net of goat's hair. Saul sent messengers to seize David, but she said he is sick. Saul, however, sent back the messengers to see David for themselves. Bring him up to me in the bed, he ordered, that he may be put to death. When the messengers came, they found the household idol, the teraphim, in the bed with the net of goat's hair on his head. Saul said to Michal, why did you play that trick on me and let my enemy get away safely? Because Michal answered Saul, he said to me, help me get away or I'll kill you. Which is, of course, not, you know, she actually, you know, hid him. But are they big or are they little? That must be big. That's of human size. King, it's a human, right, cute. It's a human-sized household idol. That goes back to the size of, you know, bigger than the Mary on the wayside. Most assuredly not something that you can put in your saddlebag as you're escaping on the non-existing camels that hadn't come into the country yet because they hadn't really been invented yet. But nonetheless, you can't put that in your saddlebag. And what you can put in your saddlebag is going to fool nobody in bed. We don't know what they are. We don't have a clue. We know that they are idolatrous. Second book of Kings, 23 to 24. Josiah also did away with the necromancers and the mediums and the idols and the fetishes. all the detestable things that were to be seen in the land of Judah and Jerusalem. Thus he fulfilled the terms of the teachings recorded in the scroll that the priest Hilkiah had found in the house of the Lord. In 620 BCE, they were doing a renovation of the temple. While they're renovating the temple, they find a scroll. Oh my God. And they read the scroll in public. First they get it authenticated. Then they read the scroll in public. It is thought to be the scroll of Deuteronomy, which is why I say Deuteronomy has that late addition of killing the false prophets. Josiah, it's his 18th year as king. He's a child. He reads this scroll, or the scroll is read to him, and he freaks out because that scroll, Deuteronomy, is really, really very clear. Kaddish Baruch Hu, only the Kaddish Baruch Hu, worship God, nobody else. Die if you don't worship God, only this one God. Die if you don't. And Josiah does away with all of the idols and the fetishes, etc. That fetishes is a stupid translation, right? All the idolatrous apparatus that were in the temple. If the temple had idolatrous apparatus, it means it was acceptable. Because the temple is the temple of God in Jerusalem, which means that the high priest is there, and the prophets are there, and the king is okay with it. That's official cult. So officially, in Yerushalayim, in Jerusalem, until we have the reforms of Josiah, we're having idolatrous worship. Josiah hears about it, right? I just brought you back the other verse. Josiah hears about it and says, oh no, this won't work, and he cleans it all out. We're going to talk about that later tonight as well for those of us who are coming back. He cleans it all out so that people will only worship God. Okay. Oops, the hell happened there? That might be the last slide. Look at that. That is the last slide. So the Josiah pictures are in the other thing. So that they will only worship God. You have the teraphim. You have the fetishes. You have the idols. You have the inappropriate looking toward omens. But it's only toward God that you're supposed to look to get your answers. Right? So this harks back to what we've been saying in some of our other talks together. You got mold on the wall? Do you call the plumber? No. Right? You've got a liver to examine. It works. It works. Because the king of Babylon went up and sacked Jerusalem. It works. Do we do it? No, we don't do it. We only do what's in terms of God. Because God gives that command that we have to stay within God's system. So when the necromancer in the story with Saul and the necromancer calls up Samuel, does it work? Yeah. Because Samuel comes up and says, leave me alone. I'm not speaking to you. You're not king anymore. It works. But it's not what we're supposed to do within the biblical text, let alone within our text. I mean, our religion, right? Not let alone in the biblical text or in our practice. That's what that sentence was supposed to be. Right? In our practice. So at the time of the Bible, this was forbidden. And in our times, it's forbidden as well. You don't resort to that. You don't go to astrologers. Not because now we don't think it works, but in that context, they thought it worked, bless you. But unless God is telling the prophet to utter these things, it's forbidden. Yes, ma'am.
How does one know, since prophets might look alike, sound alike, how does one know which is the one that God really spoke to and the one that's just saying God's spoken?
I know, that's a really tough one. The question is, how do you know if it's a prophet that God really spoke to, or if it's a prophet that God just say that God spoke to. Okay, there are a number of ways of looking at this. Okay, one is that we're going through a text that's telling us things. So the text is telling us its story. So the text is saying, this prophet is speaking the word of God, this prophet is no good, and therefore that's a lying prophet. We don't have records from the time period to look at what was really happening. Now you do have revelatory prophecy in other parts of the ancient world. You have revelatory prophecy in Mari or in Nuzi that we spoke about in some of our other classes together. And there again, you get the discussion that this prophet said this, and this then happened. Frequently, the prophets will speak in these riddle-like oracles. Right? And then the answer is always right, because a woman will kill her husband. Does it say when? Does it say she's blonde? Does it say she's a brunette? Right? Does it say in Anaheim or in Fountain Hills View Laguna? Right? Does it say? I'm just trying to put words together in my head. Does it say? It doesn't say that. It says a woman's going to kill her husband. An enemy will enter the land. Well, an enemy always enters the land. And it's like reading the horoscopes. Okay, I don't even want to ask how many of us read horoscopes, because I really, really, really don't want the answer, okay? But even when we don't read the horoscopes, if it's a paper that has the horoscope sitting on it and you're walking by, come on, right? We don't take it seriously, but sometimes don't we want to? It's really nice, or what have you. So it's that sort of thing as well. Yeah.
I don't know the text all of it enough, well enough to know the answer to this. The Israelites' prophecies, did they not come through livers and bones and all that, but through things like dreams?
Well, everybody's prophets also come through dreams, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, God speaks to whoever, and they speak to him in a vision. There has been work done that there are people who have been able to put together all the prophecies, all the speaking, and it comes through one of these major ways. I have some scholarly articles adding other ways, not the least of which is writing, because I do, you know, the text does talk about God writing and sending writing to people, and people writing and sending it to God, so that there are other ways as well.
Yeah, isn't there something in the biblical text that actually tells you, like God says, the way that you can tell if a prophet is real or not is that if what the prophet says comes true, then it was a real prophet.
Yes, but that's what I was saying. If it happens, this is good. This is what happens with the prophet. But then think about, right, the ancillary to that is the book of Jonah.
Yeah.
Jonah goes and says,
yeah,
you're all dead. And they're not all dead. Mm-hmm. And that's what upsets Jonah. Right? So you have all aspects of that within the text. Last question.
Do priests and politicians manipulate the system, as far as you know?
Do priests, what are we talking about, a politician? Are we talking about a politician?
A general wants to wage war.
Well, we don't, are you talking about in the biblical text or in general?
In
the ancillary world? Okay, I gave the example, I think last week or 2 weeks ago, when you go to the oracle and you say, is this a good day to go to war? And the response is, a great general will be victorious today. And then you go to war and you lose. Is that manipulating the system?
You weren't a great general.
Pardon me?
You were not a great general.
Correct, you were not a great general, but is that manipulating the system?
The other guy was a great general.
The other guy was the great general. So is that manipulating? I don't know if that's manipulating the system.
Yeah.
Right? So there, you know, there are questions that you have, and there are people that were brought up on in legal cases in Greece, but there's a real healthy fear of the power of the gods. And you don't, you know, it's like I say when I teach mythology, Keller's first rule of mythology, don't spit in the wind. That's my first rule of mythology. And if all of these people in the ancient world had learned this, the stories would have come out differently. But you do not piss off the gods. You don't piss off the kings. Right? The kings are in consort with the gods in a different way. But there's a healthy fear and respect. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll see some of you later. Some of you I'll see next week. Some of you I'll see tomorrow. Some of you I'll never see again. But I wish to see you all again.